So Luke, the 18th chapter, verses 1 through 8. This morning I am reading from the Message Bible because it says it best for me today. This is what the text says. Jesus told them a story showing that it was necessary for them to pray consistently and never quit. He said there was a judge in some city who never gave God a thought and cared nothing for people. A widow in that city kept after him. "My rights are being violated. Protect me." He never gave her the time of day. But after this went on and on, he said to himself, "I care nothing what God thinks, even less what people think. But because this widow won't quit badgering me, I'd better do something and see that she gets justice. Otherwise, I'm going to end up beaten black and blue by her pounding." Then the master said, "Do you hear what that judge, corrupt as he is saying? So what makes you think God won't step in and work justice for the chosen people who continue to cry out for help? Won't he stick up for them? I assure you, God will. God will not drag God's feet. But how much of that kind of persistent faith will the Son of Man find on earth when he returns?" I want to speak with you this morning. The subject, persistence and resistance. Persistence and resistance. A few weeks ago, during the Senate confirmation hearings of Senator Jefferson Beauregard Sessions for Attorney General for the United States of America, perhaps you watched as I did in astonishment as Senator Elizabeth Warren was hushed on the Senate floor when she attempted to read into the records the words accepted in the 1986 hearings led by Senator Ted Kennedy that reflected the thoughts of Mrs. Coretta Scott King, opposing and successfully challenging the appointment of Senator Sessions as then a federal judge. The next day, Senator Mitch McConnell, in response to the actions taken during the hearings, and in response to Senator Warren's unwavering resolve to have Coretta Scott King's words punctuate the moment, tweeted out, we like tweets now, "She was warned, she was given an explanation, nevertheless, she persisted." I've had a t-shirt made with those words on it. It was then that I was once again reminded of the words of Frederick Douglass that state, "Power cedes nothing without a demand. It never has, and it never will." And though Senator Dayne's instructions on the Senate floor were spoken to Senator Warren, they were in fact directed beyond her, to Senator Ted Kennedy, to Mrs. Coretta Scott King, to Dr. Martin Luther King, and to all who have fought for justice throughout the history of this nation. It was not only Senator Warren that was asked to take a seat in that moment, but it was justice herself. And the arrogance of that moment reminded me of the advantage we still hold, my friends, because history has proven that walls are not built, but walls come tumbling down when justice is asked to take a seat. I was also reminded of recent pleas by some well-meaning Christian personalities that we as people of faith remove ourselves from the physical engagement of liberative acts and resolve ourselves to just pray and trust God, as if prayer is ever a passive act. and our willingness to engage in liberative acts that seem impossible to win is not, in fact, the manifestation of our willingness to trust God in spite of what we see. There is a West African proverb that states, "When praying, move your feet," which suggests to me our human freedom and indeed our divine mandate to play an active and essential role in the effectiveness of our own prayers. It was this proverb and the words of Frederick Douglass when he famously said, "I prayed for freedom for 20 years, but received no answer until I prayed with my legs," that led a group of clergy in St. Louis, originally naming our collective response to the killing of Michael Brown Jr. 2 years ago, "Praying with Our Feet." The prayers of our ancestors were often verbal acts of resistance. Their prayers were affirmations of their belief that God is indeed a God of intervention. Their prayers were their way of preparing for battle that they knew lie ahead. I thought it appropriate this morning, after weeks of shocking executive orders and harmful confirmations, and as we gather here to worship God and to discern how we might walk closer with God as we stand against repressive policies and ideologies, that we revisit once again what it means to pray with one's feet. And this text seems to me particularly ripe for such a journey. Prayer in Hebrew scripture often becomes one of the ways in which the creature cooperates with the Creator in order to bring about God's plan. We see prayer playing this role in the stories of Abraham and Moses and Deborah and Samuel and David and Hagar and so many others. In fact, it sometimes seems in ancient texts that God so desires the obedience and cooperation of the creature that God is unwilling to carry out God's purpose until we recognize and honor our participatory role in our own prayers, our participatory role in our petitions to God. This causal relationship is not as clearly spelled out in Christian texts, which may account for some of our comfort in declaring our words alone to be enough to impact change. One of the biblical commentaries I consulted for today suggests that perhaps this is one of the reasons there is some disagreement about the intention of the petitions, even in the Lord's Prayer. "Give us this day our daily bread." What does that really mean? "Forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil." Are these calls for God to act alone? Or are they calls for God to help us achieve our request? If the latter is the case, then why ask God at all? It is certainly not to escape our responsibility for action, but rather to enter into this human-divine partnership in which we offer ourselves at God's disposal, expecting and seeking God to be at work to make our efforts effective. Now, I am not suggesting to you that work and prayer are the same thing. I know that they are not. I understand that work is not a substitute for prayer. They are not to be equated with one another. Yet neither are they to be separated from one another. In other words, prayer must include the obedience of one's own convictions and the willingness to actively seek what is good and what is just. Dormant prayer must not be a substitute for responsible action and our pursuit of justice. I can hear our brother James reminding us daily that faith without works is dead. This is what I hear Jesus saying in this parable. Jesus tells the story of a persistent woman, a widow, and of a judge who the text says does not fear God and has no concern for the people. And on first glance, it would appear that the moral of this story is simply the need to be persistent in one's petitions to God. But as I read this text over and over again, I am struck by Jesus' opening statement. Jesus admonishes the hearers to not give up, to always pray, to never lose heart. Some translations state to never quit. This seems to me to imply more than a directive to just keep talking. But rather, it is a directive to resist and to persist, to never give up on what we know is right. Who is this woman? And who is this judge? Who is the woman's opponent? What is her story? What is it that she believes so strongly that she's willing to wear this judge out? Don't you love that imagery? Wear him out until she gets it. The text does not tell us what has this woman so up in arms. But we all have had our enough moments. We all have moments when we have reached the limit of our capacity to stand idly by. On August 9, 2014, that moment came for first dozens and then hundreds and then thousands of young people as news of the killing of Michael Brown Jr. began to spread like wildfire through cyberspace. We've heard testimonies of people like Netta, who was in a grocery store when the news came across her feed, and she left her groceries in the checkout line and went straight to the streets. Stories of folk like my own member, Alicia, who showed up as the news reached her and who is still showing up over 700 days later. Stories of young people organizing buses and car caravans to travel first to Ferguson to stand in solidarity with protesters there, taking a mantra, a hashtag, Black Lives Matter, and building out the foundation of a movement in the basement of St. John's United Church of Christ. Stories of clergy and other people of faith, many of whom only knew one another in passing, forming sacred bonds with one another to stand across denominational polities and class and social stratifications and personal theologies to support one another as we pledged collectively to support the righteous rage of some of the most marginalized of our society. What is that dogged determination that will cause one to confront a judge who does not fear God and who has no respect for people? And let's be clear that one need not be a judge in a courtroom to be depicted in this narrative. As a matter of fact, I would suggest that more often than we care to admit, we are as likely to serve the role of judge in someone else's story as we are to serve the role of widow in our own. I like to imagine that the absence of naming in this story is intentional on Jesus' part, because it is far too easy for us to make someone the focus of all of our rage, far too easy to isolate the actions of a few and target them, far too easy to demonize those that we dislike, far too easy to demonize Darren Wilson, the officer who pulled the trigger that led to the death of Michael Brown. Clearly, Darren Wilson alone did not load the gun with the fear that made him feel he had to kill Michael Brown. Far too easy to demonize Trump, because he is the Goliath who has come out from among the Philistines without looking at the army from which he has come out from among. Far too easy to demonize Michael Johnson, the man who served in the military and later killed officers who were doing good in Dallas, Texas, without looking at the complexities of our context that creates the post-traumatic stress syndrome that can push people too far. Far too easy to demonize oil companies and not look at the way that we utilize the oil we villainize them for bringing. Far too easy to target our wrath at those who are visible and absolve ourselves from any complicity in the tenor of our atmosphere. Let me be clear. No political party has a monopoly on justice. No church or denomination has a monopoly on justice. No faith has a monopoly on justice. When we fail to care for the other, when we refuse to fight for justice for the other, no matter who the other may be, we do not fear God. When we ignore the injustice that afflicts our neighbor, then we care nothing for people, and our professions are empty rhetoric. Righteousness and justice have the same root word in both the Hebrew and the Greek. It is impossible to fight for righteousness and not fight for justice. It is impossible to consider ourselves to be a holy people and equally be an unjust people. So Jesus does not name her opponent. Neither does Jesus give all power to this judge. As a matter of fact, the text is explicit. This judge never changes his heart or his mind. I am particularly mindful of this fact when standing here with you this morning, realizing that there are those for whom slavery was outlawed less than 200 years ago who are still fighting for voting rights, even though a Voting Rights Act was passed 52 years ago, but was later gutted in 2013 by the Supreme Court. That we entered this national election cycle with less voting protections than we've had since the Voting Rights Act. And now we are witnessing states intentionally trying to reinstate the very types of prohibition that necessitated that Voting Rights Act in the first place. I am mindful that the Voting Rights Act did not pass because of changed hearts and changed minds. But rather it passed because righteousness and justice prevailed. It passed because while folk were praying, they got up and they moved their feet. It passed because people were willing to move by the promises of God and be doggedly persistent because they believed the scriptures and they trusted God to prevail. I would suggest to you that what we face today bears witness to the truth of this parable. For had the judge's hearts truly been changed, we would not be fighting for voting rights again today. Had the judge's hearts and minds truly been changed, we would not be fighting for justice at Standing Rock again today for indigenous people. Had the judge's heart and mind truly been changed, we would not be residents in a land where those who are hired to serve and protect have killed 3,869 Americans since the killing of Michael Brown. Had the judge's heart truly been changed, we would not be watching the formation of a presidential cabinet whose common thread is a legacy of white supremacy. The judge did not change his heart, nor his mind, but his behavior changed. His behavior changed because that widow wore him out. His behavior changed because the widow refused to quit. His behavior changed because the widow kept the faith. His behavior changed because the widow kept standing. This is not a text about an unjust judge repenting and coming to his senses. That would be great, but it's not what happened. This is a text about what is possible when we believe God. Recently, I ran across a photo that reminds me of the power of prayer. It was a photo of many of my clergy friends kneeling on a sidewalk in front of the Ferguson Police Department. You see, during the height of the Ferguson protests, there were a group of us, clergy, who made a covenant with one another that we would never let young people be out in the street without our presence there. It wasn't necessarily true that we always agreed with everything the young people were doing. As a matter of fact, that was not the case. But we saw it as our moral responsibility to make sure that no harm came to anyone during the protest. And so there was a group of us, only about a dozen of us. I know that may surprise some of you with the number of clergy that are in every area. But just as it was true in the Civil Rights March, though now we portray that march as though the church was in the front of it, that simply is not the truth. And the only saving grace in that instance is that Martin Luther King is not alive to say y'all are lying. There were only a few clergy then, and there were only a few clergy in Ferguson. And because most of us still had jobs, many of us were bivocational before Ferguson, it was impossible for us to keep up with the energy of the young people. You know what I'm saying? So we took shifts because we started out all being out there together and we quickly got tired. I remember that moment for me when I'd worked all day in my corporate job, gone to church and taught Bible study, and then headed to the streets of Ferguson for my night shift. When I arrived in Ferguson at 8:30, I was dogged tired, hundreds of young people gathering in the street, and I was trying to look cool. I was saying internally, this can't last long. It's really late. And I need some sleep so I can get up in the morning. At about 10 o'clock, when I thought things were winding down and my hope began to rise, I heard a singular voice out of the crowd yell, "Let's start marching again." They took off down the street marching. We're young, we're strong, we're marching all night long. And I had an epiphany. I ran to the front of the line and said, "Hold up a moment." They said, "What's wrong, Pastor T?" I said, "I'm old and I'm tired and I'm taking my old self home. If you get locked up, text me. I got you." But on this particular night, I was not on duty, and I'm told that the tension was particularly high between police and protesters. The police were dressed in all of their military gear, and the protesters were extremely agitated, even though they were only carrying signs. The police were tired of being out every night, tired of all the overtime, tired of the verbal disrespect, even if it was only verbal disrespect. And the protesters were tired of being arrested, tired of being shuffled to the sidewalks. And this night they had decided that they would not back down. As tensions began to rise, it was clear to clergy that if there was not an intervention, that this could possibly be the night where there might be a bloodbath. And we simply could not have that happen on our watch. So the clergy who were present decided to do the only thing that clergy know how to do in collaboration with God. And that was to pray, but not just with words, but with their feet. They formed a human chain and went between the protesters and the police officers. I'm told that getting into the human chain, they began to chant prayers in their own faith traditions. As they got to the center between the protesters and the police, they kneeled down. And one after another, they began to cry out loud to God, asking for intervention and asking for peace. One prayer after another, they just continued to pray out loud until I'm told by some of the clergy that they lost contextual awareness of their atmosphere. And when they began to become aware again, they noticed that all of the noise had ceased. They noticed that the protesters were now leaning into them, placing their hands on their backs and their shoulders. They looked up and noticed that police officers had dropped their shields and lowered their guns to their sides, and even a few of them had tears coming out of their eyes. What I'm trying to say to you is that prayer with action does change things. Prayer can change the atmosphere. Prayer can change behavior. And I don't know whether the protesters or the police changed their mind that day, but I know a God that was powerful enough to intervene in spite of what was going on, because this is what faith does. Faith shifts the atmosphere. There was no visible way that I can prove to you that their hearts changed or their minds changed, but their behavior changed in that moment. And this is the point. This is the story of God's ability to liberate in the midst of oppression. This is the story of God's faithfulness to respond in the face of unresponsiveness. This is the story of God's unfailing promise to always see us through. It is about a widow's unrelenting faith and the limitless capacity of our God to hear us and to overturn unjust systems and behaviors that seek to hold us hostage. It is about what partnership with a faithful God can do. I will grant her justice just so she doesn't wear me out any longer. I can't take the constant badgering. I can't take the constant crying out. Day and night, week after week, month after month, year after year, it often seems like justice will take forever. But we cannot give up, my friends. No matter how much they explain, we must persist and we must resist. We must pray more and plot less. We must speak out more, wear out more every obstacle to our success, confident in this one thing, that God is indeed a God of justice. And when we take God's side, now I must, in the interest of integrity, insert a note here. I said when we take God's side, not when God takes our side, but when we take God's side. Here's a clue for you if you don't get it. If your God always thinks you're right, chances are that's not the one I'm talking about. But when we take God's side, we are never alone. Our victories are won because with God we resist and we persist. I will give her justice, cried the judge, because she will not quit. How much of this type of persistent faith will Jesus find among us when he returns? Amen.